Today's shir is Masechta Megillah Daf Yotes, and we will begin in Daf Yotes Amud Aleph, sixth line from the top, Amamar. Agamar begins again to analyze in depth the brice that we learned in the previous shir, the lengthy brice we learned in the previous shir that discussed many of the halachas of Mila. Begins the Gemara, Amamar Nefesh, the pasuk in the Tirak Daisha that begins the parish of Mila. Says Nefesh Kisimal Mal, says the Brice we learned from that pasuk, Echra Yochid Vechra Nosi Vechad Hamashuach B'mashma. That the halachas of Mila apply both to a Yochid, to every individual, to a Melech, to a Kohen Gadol. Shiyachamai asked the Gemara, why would we think differently? Pshita, isn't it obvious that it should apply to all types of Jews? Nefesh Kisiv. And as the Mefarshim explained, the word nefesh indicates that anyone who has a neshama is subject to hilchas mila. And certainly, every Jew has a neshama in whatever position he is. Answers the Gemara, Madatayma Amar Rachmana, V'ish Vasha Yite Mimen Azar. The Torah tells us a pasuk that one may not put on themselves from the Shemen HaMishcha. And as we learned in Masechta Krisis, applying Shemen HaMishcha is a lav. V'hai lav zarhu, and these individuals are not in that category. D'ha imshcha begavei, because these individuals, the melech, the kohen gadol, were anointed by the Shemen HaMishcha, and therefore perhaps they ought not to be subject to hilchas me'ila. K'mash malan. That's why we need the pasuk of Nefesh to teach us that they are included in Hilchos Mila. And there are actually two approaches in Rishonim how to explain this Gemara. One way of explaining this Gemara is that the Torah is teaching us that there's an Isser for one to use the Shemen HaMishcha without a reason, only when they're being anointed for their position. And therefore we would think since these individuals are going to use the Shemen HaMishcha when they were anointed. And therefore we would think that once they're allowed to use the Shemen HaMishcha for that purpose, the Isser of applying Shemen HaMishcha doesn't apply to them. So according to that approach, it was never a Havamina of the Gemara that these individuals should be exempt from Hilchos Me'ila. Why should they be exempt from Hilchos Me'ila? The question was, should they be exempt from Hilchos Me'ila on Shemen HaMishcha teaches us the pasuk that no, that when they have to have the Shemen HaMishcha put on, then fine, otherwise they may not have the Shemen HaMishcha applied. That's one approach in the Rishonim. The other approach in the Rishonim is the Gemara was assuming that since, as we just said, there is a time when they may have the Shemen HaMishcha put on them, when they're being appointed a king, when they're being appointed a kohen gadol, since at that time they're allowed to have the Shemen HaMishcha, that should exempt them from all of Hilchos Me'ila. Teaches us the pasuk. No, that then they're allowed to have the Shemen HaMishcha, and then obviously it's not a situation of Me'ila. Other times, they are subject to Hilchos Me'ila like everyone else. And the Mefarshim explain that what is the basis of the difference of these two approaches. The basis is a very fundamental issue. As we just said a moment ago, the Torah HaKadosh with this pasuk, as we learned the Masechta Krisis, teaches us that one may not just use the Shemen HaMishcha. So now the question is, when somebody does use the Shemen HaMishcha, not for the purpose intended, is that a separate lav, or is that included in the lav of Me'ila? If we learn it's a separate lav, so we understand the Gemara like the first approach we explained. That we thought that they're excluded from that lav, teaches us the Torah did not exclude it from that lav. Mila, there was never a reason to think that they should be excluded from. If, however, we understand that this lav of putting the Shemen HaMishcha when you're not supposed to is included in the general category of Me'ila, so that's the second approach, that understands that Shemen HaMishcha is just one example of Me'ila. And since these individuals, the king and the kohen gadol, were allowed to have at one time the Shemen HaMishcha, that should cause that they should always be exempt from Me'ila, Kamash Malan, that no, then no other time. Says the Gemara, in our shiurim, particularly in yesterday's shiur, we've learned that Aksh Rachmana, the Torah has compared Mila to Saita, to Avodah Zarah, and to Truma. And as we quoted Tosfos in the previous shiur, the reason the Torah compares Mila to all of these different situations, because they represent different halachas, different types of Mila. Saita comes to teach us that Mi'ila is not limited to a situation of Shini Rishus, because a Saita, even if she has, unfortunately, this adulterous relationship, just like she was married to her husband before, still she remains married. So there is no situation of Shini Rishus here. There is a situation, however, of Hano. And as we'll see, there's no Pagam, there's no deterioration either. The Avodah Zarah does represent the halacha of Mi'ila of Shini Rishus, that when somebody, Rachmana Litzlan, worships Avodah Zarah, what he's doing is he's taking himself out, so to speak, of the Rishus of Klal Yisrael, of the Rishus of Hashem, to Rishus Avodah Zarah. And Truma comes to teach us, as we learned and will learn, all of the halachas, that what is Hano, what is benefit from Hegdash mean that do through such an act one should be violating Mi'ila. And now the Gemara drills down and tells us what we learn from every one of these cases. We learn from Saita, the Afagav Deloi Pogam. A Saita, by having this relationship, doesn't become deteriorated, as the Rishonim explain. A Saita, by definition, is a married woman. She's already a Ba'ula. She's already a woman that had relations prior to this situation. So there's no pagam that happens by having this relation. It's Hana. And we learn from here that in a situation, as we spoke yesterday, we'll speak today still again, when we have the type of article which is not subject to deterioration, to depreciation, so just by having benefit itself, one is over Me'ila. Gabe Hegdish Nami, and therefore the similar case by Hegdish, is Nosna Tabas Biyada Ma'ala. That if you use the ring, if she benefits from the ring, there's no depreciation just from wearing this piece of jewelry, but jewelry is not open to depreciation, there's Mi'ila. Furthermore, says the Gemara, Ki Aksh Rachmana L'Avodah Zarah, when the Torah compares Mi'ila to Avodah Zarah, what has come to teach us? The Ad is by Shinui. That only if there's shinui, that it goes from the Rishus of Hegdish, out of the Rishus of Hegdish, is the Mila. Gabe Hegdish, Nami, ad the beke, bekardon v'yifko pogam. Until you use the axe of Hegdish, and you depreciate it, is there no Mila. So this last words that we just read, that in order for there to be Mila with an axe, you have to depreciate the axe, is very understandable. For as we've been learning, any type of article that is open to depreciation, to deterioration, there is no meal until that actually occurred. But as the Rishonim asked, this Gemara is the opposite of everything we've been saying. We've been saying that when we compare Me'ila to Avodah Zarah, the purpose is to teach us that you need Shini Rishus. And if there's a Shini Rishus, you have Me'ila. And then the very same Gemara says, Ad the Biki Bakardim. That if you use the axe, only if you use it, only if you benefit from it, is the Mi'ila. Shini Rishus isn't enough. So how do we understand this Gemara? So some say, the Ad B'Ki B'Kardim is not connected to Avodah Zarah. It's talking about if there is a situation where there's an article which is open to use, you're not going to have Mi'ila until you depreciate it. It's not Pash P'Shah in the Gemara. Pash P'Shah in the Gemara's B'Ki B'Kardim is an example of Avodah Zarah, of the Mi'ila that we learn from Avodah Zarah. So the Rishonim Tosfos, Rabbeinu Peretz, say a very nice pshat. The halacha, so first they want to say is, that if I borrow something from you, so that's the situation, or I take something from you, Shini Rishus, but I don't become responsible if I borrow it from you, until I actually use it. So the Gemara is saying, you know when the Shini Rishus? The Shini Rishus when I actually use the article. That really isn't true, because we know that if I borrow something from you, as soon as I take it, I become responsible.
So how could the Gemara be suggesting, ask those Rishonim, that no, that there's no Shinui Rishus until I actually use it? So Rabbeinu Peretz says a very big chiddush. He says, let's say you lend me something. So at what point can you no longer change your mind? So he says as follows. As far as halacha, that I become responsible as soon as you lend it to me, as soon as I take it into my rishus. But you could still change your mind until I actually start using it. So what the Gemara is saying is that since the lender always has the opportunity to still back out until I actually use it, so it's not considered shini rishus until I actually use it, because you always have the right to back out till then. We learned further that the Torah compares mila to truma, actually rachmana to truma, ma truma ki yoichel, that the chiyah for eating, truma, the karen v'chaimish, is only if you eat it, prat l'mazik, if you just damage truma, there wouldn't be a chiyah. Gabe hegdish nami, called the bar chilif, there's a food item, ki mazik le'potter. If you just a mazik food items, you're potter from mi'ila. Interesting, machloikis rishayim. The Gemara is saying here that if your mazik hegdish or your mazik truma, the special rules that apply, keren v'chaimish, don't apply. But everybody agrees that la halacha, I would have to reimburse you if I was mazik, if I was mazik your truma, I was mazik hegdish. There is a machloikis rishayim if that's a chiv deraisa or a chiv derabbanan. Furthermore, the Gemara says that if I'm mazik a food item that belongs to Hegdish, then it's not considered Mila. So the Mefarshim ask, if the Gemara is coming to teach us that the din of mazik of Hegdish doesn't mean Mila, why did the Gemara choose a midah d'achila? Anything that belongs to Hegdish, the Gemara should be teaching us that if I mazik it, if I damage it, the halakas of Mila don't apply. So the simple teretz is because we're learning from Truma, and Truma is a bar achila. So since Truma is a bar achila, so that's why we speak a bar achila by Hegdish. But certainly it's not limited to Hegdish. Other Rishonim say a very nice teretz. What would be the halacha if it's a food item, and I ate the food item with an achila gasa? I wasn't able to eat, I just forced myself to eat. Would that be considered me'ila, because I ate it, and it's a food item, or is it considered mazik? Says Tosfos, the Gemara is telling us a chiddush, that if you ate a food, b'achila gasa, in a form of hezek, it's not mila. It's mazik. It's not achila. Rav Shach takes this Gemara a step further than Aviezer. He's saying that we're comparing the aloch of mila to the aloch of hegdish. What is the Gemara teaching us? He's saying that the Gemara is teaching us that hegdish is a new legal entity. It's a different entity than an individual. And if all of the halachas that apply by individual of mazik don't apply by hegdish, because they're a separate category. So the Gemara said, we learned in the Mishnah, and we just learned in the Gemara a moment ago, that what is an example of an article that is not subject to depreciation, that there is me'ila, even if you didn't depreciate it? Ketz and Nosan Katla. If somebody took a piece of jewelry that belongs to hegdish, so that's not something that deteriorates. Says the Gemara, Amle Rav Kahanel Rav Zvid, for the Havala Bar of Kumihu, is that true that gold doesn't depreciate? For the Hava the Kalsa the Nun, the gold that was owned, a gold jewelry that was owned by Nun's daughter-in-law, like Ozel, she ruined it. So we see that it's subject to depreciation. Amle, the Dilma the Hava the Ramni Kalesachu, she, it's like the jewelry that your daughter-in-law wore, that she was particularly not careful with the jewelry, and she ruined it. But under normal use, it doesn't get ruined. Void, and another explanation, you're right, normally jewelry doesn't depreciate immediately. It doesn't depreciate ever. Of course it ultimately depreciates. But the fact that it doesn't happen automatically or quickly exempts it from the requirement that in order that there should be mila, you have to have depreciation. And I saw Rebbe Yoshev in a Sefer says a very nice way of determining And as our Gemara keeps on repeating that, our Gemara keeps on repeating that, how do we know if it's something is subject to depreciation, then it's not, then it has mila only if you depreciate it. If it's not subject to deterioration, then there is no mila through deterioration. How do I know in what category that article belongs? So he says a very nice way of determining. He says, everything's up for rent. There's a business that will rent everything. He says, but there are certain things that when you rent them, the person who's renting them out, when he is figuring out his cost, takes depreciation into consideration. When you rent a car, you think about depreciation. When you rent a garment, you certainly think about depreciation, because you only can wear a garment that many times before it gets ruined. When you rent jewelry, yes, Al Gemara says jewelry gets depreciated, but it takes so long for the jewelry to depreciate, the person who's renting the jewelry is taking a lot of financial issues into consideration, but he's not taking depreciation into consideration. That's why it's considered an article that's exempt from consideration, from depreciation. We learned in the Mishnah, Henenis Menachatus. So the Mishnah said that if somebody had a Norf Menachatus, so the Mishnah passed as follows. Henenis Menachatus, if it's a live animal, Lemarat Shivkan, it's not considered you did Mila until you deteriorated it. Kivin Shemesa, but if it's dead, Kivin Shenen, if you have, since it's not open to deterioration, as soon as you benefit from it, you amal. Ask the Gemara. Michti, let's understand. So first of all, the Mefarshim explain that why does the Mishnah choose a chatas from all animals? So Mefarshim explain, and we'll appreciate this more on the days, because a chatas is an animal that comes from a female. And a female usually has more wool than a male. And we're going to speak in the Gemara Namad Beis about the mi'ila on the wool of an animal. And that's why we spoke, the Mishnah speaks about a chatas. But ask the Gemara, michti, if we're talking about a healthy animal, the animal that's not a balmum, and the Rishonim say a very important explanation here. They say as follows, if our Mishnah is speaking about that you have an animal that's a carbon, and it's a kosher carbon, and you are moil, and the Mishnah says that in order to do me'ila, you have to depreciate it. Why? What has your depreciation accomplished? What do I mean? If you have an animal that you are magnish for a carbon, yes, it depreciated. You can still use it for your carbon. And since you could still use it for your carbon, your depreciation is meaningless. So why should you be responsible for it? So that can't be the case of the Mishnah. We're speaking about an animal that's a balmum. So you can't use that animal for carbon. It's a balmum. What are you going to do with the animal? As we've learned who knows how many times, you're going to sell that animal. You're going to sell that animal and use the proceeds for new carbon. Now, if you depreciated the animal, that makes a difference, because you're going to get less proceeds for the animal, and that's why the meal is only if you depreciate the animal. Whereas if it's a dead animal, we'll speak about this more, then it does make a difference. And therefore, your mi'ila is as soon as you benefit. So this Gemara is actually used to discuss a very interesting question. Let's say someone steals an esrog from someone else on Sukkos. And the esrog that he stole is a very expensive esrog. It's a $500 esrog. So the Pais can discuss, what is the halacha? Could he, and now the person wants to do tshuva. So he gives back a $50 esrog. Has he fulfilled his obligation or not? So the Maram Mintz suggests that he has. Why does he suggest that he has? He says it's based on Al Gemara. Because what do Al Gemara say? We look at the use of the item. That's what the Gemara said. If you took a healthy animal and you depreciated it, and before it was usable for carbon, and now it's usable for carbon, what you did is meaningless. Here too, if someone stole a $500 esrog and he gives back a $50 esrog, they're both kosher esrogim. So why shouldn't it be good? They give it back to the person who he could use it for the mitzvah. And in fact, the Maram Mintz quotes a Gemara. The Gemara, I think it's Gemara Bava Kama. The Gemara says that if somebody stole an animal which was hegdish, a cow, and he returns a keves, a much smaller animal, a lamb, fine, because the person who he stole from obligated himself to bring a carbon. Yes, he had designated an expensive big animal, and now you're replacing it. The ganav is replacing it with a small animal, but the small animal could be used to fulfill his obligation. It's fine. The Chacham Tzvi, the Mishnah Lamelech disagree. Because they say that when you look at an Esrig, it's not just there because you need it for a mitzvah. Esrig is also something you could sell. So if somebody stole a $500 Esrig, that the person he stole it from could have sold it for $500, and now he gives him back a $50 Esrig that he could only steal, that he could only sell for $50, so there's a loss that has to be paid back. And they say a very nice concept. They say a very nice logical raya. They say like this. What would the Maram Min say if someone stole not from an individual, but from an Esrig merchant, a $500 Esrig? That means it's his business to sell Esrigim. And someone steals from him a $500 Esrig. And then he wants to do tshuva. And he gives him back a $50 Esrig. Would anybody suggest that that's acceptable? Of course not. He's in the business of selling Esrigim. So if you took away from him an Esrig that he could sell for $500, and you replace it with an Esrig that he could only sell for $50, you haven't given back what you stole. So they say to the Maram Mintz, it makes no sense to differentiate if you stole it from a merchant or you stole it from an individual. If when you stole from the merchant, the Maram Mintz could recognize that you have to return the value that you stole. The same thing should be when you stole it from an individual. But then the Marsham makes the question a little more complicated. The Marsham says, in the case that the Maram Mintz and the Chacham Tzvi and the Mishnah Melech discuss, we're dealing with a ganef. We're dealing with a ganef. So a ganef, you know, it's hard to have rachmanis on. But what happens, and this could happen, rachman al tzlan, somebody borrows a pair of tefillin from someone else. He needs the tefillin, he borrows it. And while it's in the hands of the borrower, it got stolen. He didn't do anything wrong, but it got stolen. And he's responsible. A shal is responsible for geneva. Parshas Mishpatim. So now when he replaces the tefillin, let's say the tefillin that he had borrowed were expensive pair of tefillin, must he replace them with the same type of expensive tefillin? Or is it enough that he replaces it with kosher tefillin? Marsham says, even though here we're not dealing with a ganef, but it's the exact same machlokes. And he says, according to the Chacham Tzvi in the Mishnah Lamelech, it would have to be replaced with an expensive pair of tefillin. Before we go on to the Mishnah, the Chassidish Sfarim say, Ki yoichel prat lamazik. So the Chassidish Sfarim say, Ki yoichel, based on what we eat, prat lamazik, that will save us from all types of hezek. If your person is careful to eat only kosher food, then he'll stay away from mazikim. And if he's not, chas v'shalom. Says the Mishnah. A din that we also discussed in our previous year. Nena ke b'chatzi pruta, pagim chatzi pruta. So we've been learning that in order to violate milah, if it's an article that's open to depreciation, you're only over milah if you were nena and pagim. So says the Mishnah, if you were nena chatzi pruta and you were pagim chatzi pruta, or should nena b'shava pruta b'davar echad, or pagim b'shava pruta b'davar acher, that means you had a nah from hegdish, and you were pagim hegdish, but not at the same time. That means, let's say you had a nah from drinking the oil, but you had enough from smearing the oil, but you weren't paigim it, or you were paigim it and not nena. Loy mal, there is no mila. Achiyana b'shava pruta b'shagim b'shava pruta. You have to have both hanor and pigima, b'dava echad. So the Rishash points out that let's say our Mishnah is saying that if it's something that's open for depreciation, you're not over for mila, and unless you have hanor and pigima. And he says a bichidish. Let's say you had a hanor of shava pruta, or you had a begim of shava pruta. But the other aspect, that means you had a begim of a shava pruta, but the no was less than a pruta, or you had a no of a shava pruta, but the begim was less than a pruta, you're not chayiv until you had both hano and begima that are worth a pruta. So Asemis asks an interesting question. Let's say you had a no and begima, as the halacha requires, by something which is subject to begima, but one was more than the other. It's hard to have an exact match. So the benefit was more of a value than the begima. So when now you have to pay keren v'chaimish, what do we take into consideration that you should have to pay? The begima part or the hanor part? So he says that he doesn't answer it, but the achronim say we go with whatever was more valuable.
Says the Mishnah, as we said earlier in our shiur today, we said earlier in our shiur that what is the definition of Me'ilah? The word Me'ilah, many Rishonim say, represents Shini Rishus, that was taken from the Rishus Hegdish into the Rishus of this individual. So if that is what Me'ilah represents, so if somebody did Me'ilah, so he already took it out of Hegdish. So if somebody took something that was Hegdish and took it away, so the next person wouldn't be Oiva Me'ilah anymore, right? Because it's not Hegdish. And therefore says the Mishnah, if you took something of Hegdish and you were Me'ilah with it, it can no longer be subject to Me'ilah. Except, says the Mishnah, the two exceptions are if you magdish an animal for Hegdish, and then somebody went and used that animal, and the Mishnah is going to give illustration, and then somebody else used that animal, both of them will be over Mila. And the same thing with Klisharis. If somebody used the Klisharis, that was Hegdish obvious, and then the next person used it, and what's the reasoning? Very simple. Because they remain Hegdish, even if the first person used it. And therefore, the next person could be over Mila. And the Mishnah illustrates, Ketzad, Rachel al Gabahema, somebody was riding on an animal, and then Bachaver v'rachav, and another person, or Bachaver v'rachav, and then another person, Kolam Wolam. They all did Mila. The Rishonim point out, why do we have to have the same story three times? To teach us a Chiddush. That even though this animal was used three times for personal benefit, so we have a Chazaka, doesn't change the halacha. Each one of them violated Mila. Another example. Shas v'kaishazov, somebody drank in a gold cup belonging to Hegdish, or Bach Haveri v'shasa, and then a second individual did so, or Bach Haveri v'shasa, and then a third individual, Kulam Malu. They all violated Me'ila. Tolosh Menachatas. This goes back to what I said earlier in the shiur. If somebody plucked off the wool of a Chatas, Uba Chaver V'Tolosh, and then another person, Uba Chaver V'Tolosh, and then a third person, Kulam Malu. So the Mefarshim, two observations I'd like to repeat. One is that we learned earlier in the Masechta that if you take the eggs of a Hegdish animal, or you take the milk of a Hegdish animal, you haven't violated Me'ilah. So they ask, why is the wool different than the eggs and the milk? And they answer, because the eggs and the milk aren't an inherent part of the animal, whereas the wool keeps the animal warm, so the wool is considered part of the animal, therefore the wool is different than the eggs and the milk. Another question that the Mefarshim I saw ask is the Mishnah is trying to teach us the same concept over and over. Why do we need to have three cases? The animal that you rode on, the milk that you drank, and the plucking of the wool. So they connect it to what we learned earlier in our shiur today. Because in our shiur today we've learned the Me'ilah could be accomplished in different ways. It could be accomplished through deterioration. It could be accomplished through Hanah. It could be accomplished through Shini Rishus. And all of these examples represent those types of situations. When you ride on an animal, that represents deterioration and Hanah. When you drink the milk, it's Hanah. And when you pluck the wool, it represents Shini Rishus, that you're taking the wool from the Rishus of Hegdish to your own Rishus. And therefore, it's considered Mila. There's another question that the Achronim discuss. The Mishnah speaks about animal that you rode on. In other words, it's an animal that you were magdish for a carbon, and then you went and used it to ride on. Now, most animals that are the type of animals that you would use for carbon are not animals that you would normally ride on. You can't bring in a carbon from a horse. You can't bring a carbon from a camel. You bring a carbon from a cow, from a lamb, from a goat. These aren't animals that are typically used for riding. So some Achronim want to say, a very big chumra, that from here we see that you could be over Me'ila, even Shaloi Kedarech Hanah. Even if it's not the normal way of using it, but if you had benefit, it's already Me'ilah. Other Achroidim disagree, because normally in Halach we know that Shaloi Kedarech Hanah is not considered an act. That they say that we must be referring to an animal that even though it's not typically maybe used for riding, it is sometimes used for riding, and that's enough to make it into a Derech Hanah, and that's why Yechai Me'ilah, otherwise you would not be. Concludes the Mishnah. Rabbi Omer, Kol Davar She'ein LePidyon, Yesh Bo Me'ilah HaMe'ilah. Anything that's not open to redemption is subject to Mila after Mila. And obviously the question, which the Gemara will address momentarily, as we need to understand what's the Nafkamina between the Tanakhama and Rebbe. Begins the Gemara, Mani Masnisan, who is the Tan of our Mishnah, that says that both by Klisharis and by Behema, there's Moil Ach Moil. Mani Masnisan, says the Gemara of Nechemyahi. It represents the opinion of Nechemyah. The Tanya, Ein Moil Ach Moil, the only situation, according to the Tanakhama, where Mila could be repeated on the same article, El Behema Vad, only by animal. As our Mishnah just said, Behemoth Klisharis. Both Behemoth and Klisharis are subject to repeated Me'ilas. Ask the Gemara, my time of the Tanakhama, what is the reasoning for the Tanakhama? Answers the Gemara, to suffer, binyan of the Behemoth Ksiv. The Torah Akdoisha teaches us extra words in the Parashah Me'ila, the Ksiv Be'ela Osham. What is the Torah coming to teach us? That an animal is subject to repeated Me'ilas. And the Karen Oyer has a beautiful way of explaining the Gemara. He explains the Gemara as follows. He says, if you think about it, of course an animal should be subject to repeated Me'ilas. If the animal is Hegdish, every time you use it, you Oyver Me'ila. Why do I need a Pasuk? He says, indeed you don't need a Pasuk to teach us that animals are subject to repeated Me'ilas. So why does the Torah say Be'ela Asham? Says the Karen Ayur that according to the Tanakhama, the Torah is teaching us with these words that only an animal is subject to repeated Me'ilas, but not Klisharis. So it's not so much to teach us the din of an animal, according to the Tanakhama, it's more to teach us that a Klisharis is not. Ask the Gemara of Nechemyah. Nechemyah says that Klisharis is also a type of Hegdish, which is subject to repeated Me'ilas. Where does he take it from? Amalach. He says to you, it's based on a Kav HaChomer. In Mecheir Mevila Kedushasan, he says that Kli Sharus is more Kadosh than a Behema. Why? Because a Behema indeed has it in a Kedushas Aguf, but it doesn't bring Kedusha to anything else. He asks my Lekoshkein, let's think about a Kli Sharus. Let's remember Masechta Menachos. When we learned Masechta Menachos, we learned that how does a Mincha become Kadosh? By putting the ingredients into the Kli Sharus. So we see that the Klisharis has the highest level of Kedusha. Because not only is it itself Kaddish, but it has the ability to make other things Kaddish. So something like a Behema, which is only it itself Kaddish, is subject to repeated Me'ilas, certainly a Klisharis. So there's a beautiful discussion between the Makna and the Pnei Yeshua on Rav Nechemyah's Svara. Rav Nechemyah just said a Svara. He says that what makes Klisharis so susceptible to repeated Me'ilas, the fact that it has this quality that it can make other things Kaddish. So they discuss and they say, you know, not every Klisharis has that characteristic. Yes, the Klisharis that I mentioned, that you put the ingredients of the Karban Mincha, have that characteristic. But they ask, what about other Klisharis? For example, the garments that a Kohen wears, they're considered Klisharis, but they don't make something else Kaddish. Or, Mitzvah Shem, we're going to soon learn Masechta Tamid. And Masechta Tamid, we discuss that they had like pitchforks that they moved the coal around on the Mizbeach, or the Evarim Bedarim. Those Klisharis, they are Klisharis, but they're not Magdish anything. So they ask, what does Rabbi Nechemyah mean? Very fundamental question. What does Rabbi Nechemyah mean? Does Rabbi Nechemyah mean to say that since we find that there are Klisharis that have this characteristic, that not only are they Kaddish, but they're Magdish other things as well. Therefore, Klisharis fall into the category of an item. They fall into the category of an item that is always subject to repeated Me'ilas. That's one way of understanding Rav Nechemyah. Another way of understanding Rav Nechemyah, that Rav Nechemyah's comments are limited to Klisharis that have the ability to be Magdish other things. But if you're going to have a Klisharis, I gave examples, the Big Tikkuna, that aren't the type of Klisharis that have the ability to be Magdish other things, those Klisharis would not be subject, even according to Rav Nechemyah, to repeated Me'ilas. The way you say this in the yeshivas, is it a simen or a siba? Continues the Gemara. So we learned in the Mishnah, we mentioned this, Rabbi Oyma called Davish Ein Pidyon, Yesh Boi Ma'ilach Ma'il. Asked the Gemara, where's the Nafkamin with the Tanakhama? Answers the Gemara, Amar Rava, the Nafkamin is Ikka B'nai Eitzim. If somebody was Magdish Eitzim, the Tanah Rabbanan, as we learned in Masechta Menuchos,
If somebody obligates to bring himself wood to the Mizbeach. So says the Tanakhama, if somebody says, I'm going to bring wood, he has to bring at least two logs. Rabbi Omer, Rabbi says a lot more. Eitzim, carbon hang. He holds they have all of the halacha of a carbon. And therefore, v'tuna melech, they require salt, as the Torah says, a kol karboncha takriv melech. Tunim tenufa, as Rishonim explain, since the carbon eitzim is in the parasha of carbon mincha, and by carbon mincha there's a requirement for tenufa, they're going to require tenufa. They're going to require kamitza. Amar Rava, ledivrei Rebbe, eitzim tenum eitzim. If they are independent carbon, so just like by every carbon, you have to have wood to burn the carbon, you're going to have to burn winged wood. The Rishonim say other nafkaminas. The halacha is that when you bring a carbon, when somebody would bring a carbon, he would have to stay overnight in Yerushalayim. So if bringing Eitzim is considered a carbon, you're going to have to stay overnight. If bringing Eitzim is not a carbon, you don't have to stay overnight. Another halacha is when somebody, Rachmanel Tzlan, is an oinen, you can't bring a carbon. So if Eitzim is a carbon, he can't bring the carbon. If it's not a carbon, that he can bring when he's an oinen, Rachmanel Tzlan. Another nafkamina. The Torah says that when somebody donates a carbon, the Torah uses the word nefesh. You can't take a partner. So if it's a carbon, you can't bring a partner. If it's not a carbon, you can take a partner. So what's the Gemara teaching us? That's the nafkamina. The nafkamina is, according to the Tanakhama, Eitzim are not a carbon. So if they're not a carbon, they don't have this Kedushas Aguf. So the special rule that we're learning in the Mishnah of Yesh Moel Ach Moel would not apply. Whereas according to Rebbe, they're considered a carbon, and a carbon has a Kedushas Aguf, and is subject to repeated Me'ilas. Interesting question that the Mepharshim discuss. According to Rebbe, that was saying that a Rebbe considers Eitzim a carbon, and we have to do Kmitza. So that means you have to, I guess, chip off from the wood, and put that part in the Mizbeach. So now the question is, what's with the remainder? Because what happens by a carbon mincha? When you bring a carbon mincha, the kmitza is put on the mizbeach, and the rest of the carbon is eaten by the carbon, by the kahanim. It's eaten by the shirayim, are eaten by the kahanim. What will be the halacha with the shirayim of your eitzim? The shirayim of your carbon eitzim. Are they given to the kahanim, like the shirayim of all carbon mincha, or the shirayim of this carbon put on the mizbeach? And according to the opinion, it goes a little further. According to the opinion that the shirayim of carbon eitzim are also put on the mizbeach, will the halacha that the Gemara just said, that you have to put salt on it, be limited to the kmitza part, or will it even be on the rest of the wood as well? That's one nafkamina the Gemara suggests. Rapapa gives another nafkamina. Kachim mizbeach tamimim v'nas balamumim v'ava v'shachtim ikka v'nayim. We know, halacha that we mentioned even today, shir already, that if you have an animal that's a kadosh, that's hegdish, that becomes balmum, so what you're supposed to do is redeem it. If somebody went, instead of redeeming it, he shechted it. V'tanya, as we learned in a braisa, kach mizbeach tamim v'nasa balmum v'ovin shachtam, Rebbe oim yikavru, they should be buried, v'chama miyiftu, v'chama hold that they should be redeemed. What is the machlaikus all about? The machlaikus is, we know that when Hegdish has to be redeemed, you need to have Hamada v'Harocha. You can't have Hamada v'Harocha on a dead animal that was slaughtered already. You can't stand it up. So Rebbe holds you can't have Hamada v'Harocha. You cover, they should be buried. The Chum hold, Yiftu, they could be redeemed. So according to the Chumim, that they could be redeemed, so they don't have a Kedushas Aguf. Only something that has in it an inherent Kedushas Aguf that cannot be redeemed is subject to moil achamoil, subject to repeated milas. And therefore this animal, which can be redeemed, will not be subject to repeated milas. Whereas Rebbe holds, your kavru must be buried, it has the kedushas aguf, there's nothing you could do with it, you can't redeem it, so the only thing you could do with it is bury it, so it has a kedushas aguf. And as our Mishnah taught us, anything that's not open for redemption, anything that has that type of kedushas aguf, will be subject to repeated milas.